Welcome to the NOLA Drinks Show. Join us as we explore the world of drink and food in New Orleans and beyond. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody, Brian Diaz here with you. Welcome to the NOLA Drinks Show. Thanks for tuning in this week. As always, got a really good show coming up for you here. We chat with three fantastic chefs, all from the New Orleans area. We chat with Frank Brightson, owner, executive chef of Brightson's Restaurant. We chat with Philip Lopez, who is the executive chef of Galatoire's. And we chat with Isaac Toops, owner and chef of Toops South and Toops Meadery. And we talk about Southern cooking traditions, some of the similarities, some of the differences. We also talk about the importance of paying it forward. All three of these guys benefited by working under someone and then are now paying it forward to bringing up that next generation, something that we take very seriously here in New Orleans. Chef Frank, for example, came up under Paul Prudhomme, opened up his own place with Paul's help in the mid-1980s, and he has already overseen, if you will, or helped tootle more than one generation of up-and-coming chef and let them get out there on their own with all the love and support they need. Isaac and Philip have similarly benefited from working with others and are in the process also of paying it forward. And everybody really understands in New Orleans what that means. It is woven into the fabric of the culinary and hospitality tradition here. People are not your enemies if they open up another restaurant. If somebody started out underneath you, it's proliferation that we all like to see around here. And that's a really cool thing that we also talk about. Of course, one of the things that we talk about as well, I shouldn't say of course, but you might imagine where we're going to go with this. Coming up on November 9th is Boudin Bourbon and Beer, that very fine event put on by the Emeril Lagasse Foundation that benefits youth charities. Basically, the idea is to fund organizations that give certain youths, underserved youths, underprivileged youths, a chance to find a path. Oftentimes, it has a culinary connection to it, but not necessarily. It raises a ton of money. It's a fantastic event. It takes place, as I said, Friday, November 9th at Champion Square, right next to the Superdome. And the cool thing about it is you have scores of chefs out there, and it's the executive chefs themselves that come to the event. You can't just send somebody else. They got to be there. So go check that out. You can find them online. We talk a lot about the event coming up and how you can get tickets and all that good stuff. But it's going to be great food, great live music, really, really, really a lot of fun and for a great cause. Hey, and one of the things that we get to do too is they stick around for another shot with NOLA Drinks, our podcast only portion. So if you're listening on the radio, be sure to go to noladrinks.com or go to your favorite podcast platform and get that. And by that time, we had sipped on a fair amount of bourbon. We were drinking bourbon by our good friend's widow, Jane, our guest from a couple weeks ago, Lisa Wicker, who is the head distiller there. And yeah, so we got into some bourbon and we were talking about cooking and some really cool stuff. Shout out to our friends at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum who hosted us for that or this upcoming interview that you're about to hear. Also want to mention real quickly, next week, a really good show. Our featured interview is with Jason Johnston Ellen, who is with Single Cask Nation and also the host of the podcast, One Nation Under Whiskey. And we talk a lot about what they do at Single Cask Nation. They are an independent bottler. So we talk about what that means, taste some beautiful expressions of rare scotch, understanding the independent bottling industry and how it kind of yin and yangs with the traditional distilleries. What we're tasting typically are stuff made by these famous distilleries, but it's a different expression. And we'll get into that. And also a very special feature that we have coming up. We are over at Two Jags for a segment, the second oldest restaurant in New Orleans, established in 1856, and we are celebrating the 100th anniversary of the iconic cocktail invented there, the Grasshopper. We're going to have a demo for you. We interview Mark Ladder up on the balcony, who's the proprietor, and you're going to be able to see the demo of making the drink in that interview from the balcony on our IGTV episode, so be sure to check that out. Friends, we're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show, and then we're going to be over at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum talking to three great chefs. Come on back.
Well, after I'm through this bottle of wine, I'm gonna take you out, girl, and spend some time.
Brian Diaz here with the NOLA Drink Show. Hey, the second annual South African Wine Week returns to New Orleans from November 7th through the 13th. Explore this fascinating wine region, one of my favorites, that produces truly excellent wines all at a great value. Some of your favorite bars, restaurants, and bottle shops around the metro area will host dinners, happy hours, special tastings, and more. Join the conversation online using the hashtag SAWineWeek. To get more information and see event listings, visit SAWineWeekNOLA.com. Cheers, y'all. All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Yeah, and in IGTV land, too. Yeah, we're filming a little bit of a video segment. We're here at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum right next door to Toop South, and I'm very pleased to be joined by three fantastic chefs. Chef Isaac Toops, okay, and I'll call you fantastic, man.
I'll take any compliment I get. I'm married with children.
They're perfect. There you go. I mean, you guys are going to back me up on the fantastic thing with this guy?
Absolutely. Oh, God. Okay. Yeah, okay. Just lay it on.
Right. I would like to think he's infamous. He's more than famous.
I prefer infamous than famous.
Great. And also Chef Philip Lopez, yes. Now currently of Galatoire's.
That is correct.
Thank you for being here, Philip. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. It's an honor to be here.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And Chef Frank Bryson from Bryson's.
Very nice to be here. Thank you.
Thank you, Frank Bryson. Yeah, absolutely. So definitely have some talent here, friends, and we're going to talk a little bit about Boudin Bourbon and Beer. It's sort of what's bringing us all together, a great event happening shortly in November. But what I wanted to do, gentlemen, as we talked about before we went on the air here, talk a little bit about South Louisiana cooking and what that means. And I think a lot of folks around here probably have some familiarity with it and know some of the differences in the regional styles and considerations. But a lot of our listeners that are listening from abroad farther afield kind of, I think, sometimes tend to lump these things in together. Just thoughts on that, you guys. How would we kind of break this down in a way that might be meaningful to people, Frank?
Well, I think I've seen massive changes in the way the world views Creole and Cajun in my lifetime. And I think a real turning point was around 1980 when Chef Paul Perdome opened K. Paul's in New Orleans. I grew up in New Orleans. Chef obviously was from Cajun country in Opelousas. And I felt the differences in our cultures. And the food was the same, too. But to bring Cajun cooking to a restaurant in downtown New Orleans was really a big move. Mm-hmm. And over the next few years, the lines blurred between Cajun and Creole, but in their original form, they're quite different. And it's cultural differences, really. Acadian or Cajun cuisine or food, really, is French, country French, sort of. Creole culture and cuisine is more multicultural.
Okay.
And I think that's the biggest delineation.
Okay, fair enough. Philip, do you have any, what are your thoughts on that as far as things started to kind of merge? I mean, how would we have described New Orleans cuisine then? Is it a sort of a melting pot of these different cuisines that happen in the city? It's a little more French and classic, right? A little more Italian in nature?
Well, truly, honestly, I believe it's a melting pot of a lot of different cuisines globally. Growing up as a kid, my mother owned a printing shop here on Tulane Avenue. And the people that we hired in that shop was predominantly like Vietnamese, they were Cuban, they were Indian. So my whole ideology of New Orleans food growing up was media noches, was garam masalas, and Vietnamese pho. And I was born here in New Orleans and moved outside because my father spent years in the military, so we traveled around constantly. And so being away from New Orleans and in my high school years and my younger years, people would always ask me, where are you from? And I was like, well, I'm from New Orleans. And they're like, oh, gumbo and jambalaya. And I had no clue what the hell they were talking about. I was like, what? And so, it was weird. Like, moving back in 2004, I had to reimmerse myself what the true history of our cuisine was. And it is a big melting pot, a huge melting pot of cultures, like Frank said, of flavors. And we do get pigeonholed into this funny speaking alligator wrestling type of people, but we are so much more than that.
Right,
those are my people. Sorry.
and Isaac, see, those are your people, man. So and that's a great point. I wanted to get your take on this because you're kind of associated more or less, I guess, with Cajun cooking, but there's a huge variation. I think a lot of people don't understand the differences within Cajun cooking, say when we talk a little closer to the water versus people further up north and things. There's quite a bit of a variation in that landscape as well.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head because my mother is what's called a prairie Cajun, okay. And my father's a coastal Cajun, coming from two different areas of Cajun country. And not a lot of people actually know about the dichotomy of Cajun cooking that way. So it's wonderful to see, my father taught me how to boil crawfish and shuck oysters and go fishing and fry those fish. And my mother had more of the rice dishes and Native American influences. And that side of the family is one that has all the cochon de lait and the hog roast. Mm-hmm. So growing up, I had this wonderful duality of Cajun cuisine that I didn't realize I was getting. I mean, now I realize it. Now I realize I was extremely lucky to have that.
Where did you grow up, Isaac?
I grew up in Rain, Louisiana, which is outside Lafayette, because no one knows where Rain, Louisiana is. I think people know where Opelousas is because of Chef Ball.
Yeah.
And when it comes to New Orleans cooking, it's the melting pot is what it is. And people people assume that they're getting straight Cajun and straight Creole, when a lot of times it's this big mix of a multitude of regions and culinary adventures. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with the wonderful food we're all putting out. We're all three at this table put out slightly different versions of Creole and Cajun. And I do some traditional Cajun cooking, but I also do some exotic work as well. You know, I'm not just gumbo and po'boys and whatnot. There's nothing wrong with gumbo and po'boys, trust me.
Sure, absolutely. They work for a reason. They've been around for a while.
Yeah, they're classics.
Well, Frank, let me ask you this question, because you mentioned the difference between Cajun and Creole somewhat being cultural. I read a quote somewhere, and I'm forgetting who it was attributed to, but talking about their explanation of the difference was simply the personalities behind the two. Is that really a fair statement, do you think, or is that kind of giving it short shrift of some of the actual differences?
No, I don't think that even scratches the surface. Yeah. and you can really look at the way New Orleans itself has changed in the last 20 years as an example of the richness and diversity of Creole cuisine. It's not four or five dishes. It's a whole way of doing things. And it's all influenced by the cultures that have come into this city over the last 300 years. My great-grandfather came from Norway, but Native American influence, French, Spanish, German, etc. But look how much the city has changed since Katrina. Post-K, as we say, or in the new Orleans, the demographics have changed so much, mm-hmm. because so many people have moved here to New Orleans from other parts of America and other parts of the world. Therefore, the palate is more diverse. Mm-hmm. And so when we look at the restaurant landscape today, there's a lot of new restaurants in the last 18 years, but very few of them are serving gumbo and po'boys. It's easier to find a taco now.
Right.
And what that says is we have to sort of redefine Creole, because it is, in its very nature, a very expandable concept. We've had immigrants move here from all over the world, and many for reasons that were not of their own choosing. Mm-hmm. You know, as people, as humans, we don't often embrace radical change, but it's circumstances or disasters or something like that that forces us to change. Mm-hmm. So whether it be the Haitian Revolution in the 1870s and people fled Haiti to come here, or the Vietnam War and people fled South Vietnam to settle here in South Louisiana and become shrimpers and fishermen and farmers, or whether it's Katrina that brought new people in the medical profession, people that fell in love with the culture and decided to move here, it's constantly evolving, constantly changing. And mm-hmm. so we have to, as a homegrown, born and raised New Orleanian, it took me a minute, but I realized I had to expand my concept of what is New Orleans cuisine and what is Creole. I mean, I think a great example of that is Chef Nina Compton, who is from St. Lucia in the Caribbean, and, you know, her restaurant, Compare Le Pain and Bywater American Bistro, have been very well received here, and for good reason. But I told someone, we were doing a joint interview, and I was representing like old New Orleans and she's new New Orleans, and I said, Nina's goat curry is just as Creole as my trout meunier.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And that's the truth.
Yeah, that's a great point. Well, Phil, let me ask you this question, kind of building on something that Frank just said, with a lot of the patterns of people moving to New Orleans, especially post-Katrina, Frank, as you said, from other parts of America, not just some of the places that we associate with traditional cuisine from the area, French, Italian, Spanish, German.
Sure.
You did some very creative things, and did that affect your approach? Different people coming here and different things that you started to see?
I think so. You know, right after Katrina, there was a lull in the city that, you know, I think every New Orleanian can attest to, that we felt like we were all lost. You know, we felt like we didn't have a future. We didn't have a path to travel on. We didn't know if the city was going to rebuild. We didn't know if, you know, it was a very dark place for a lot of people. And so for me, it was more about doing something different, because I think we were all sick and tired of just eating Frito-Lay chips and MREs, you know, and it was just like, I wanted to just cook something that was exciting, that was innovative, that was, revolutionary, but also evolutionary too. I thought, you know, when you're at a point of total destruction, There is no right or wrong, you know. So being able to do something as drastic as modern cuisine in a city so embedded in traditional history was very revolutionary, and it wasn't meant to outwash or pay disrespect, but it was meant to bring light to a different part of our community, a part that we all just want to change. We all just wanted to be better. We all wanted to grow and just not really forget, but move on.
Gotcha.
And so, you know, I literally said to all my employees the moment we opened, right before we opened the doors, I said, we're going to do something that's very bipolar. We're either going to be extremely hated or we're going to be very well welcomed. And luckily, we were very well welcomed. And
which spot are we talking about, Phillips?
That was Root.
With
was,
Root.
Yeah, yeah. Root was our first restaurant that we opened.
What year was that?
That was November 2011.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, a restaurant like that would have never existed if it wasn't for something as drastic as Katrina. Just like Frank said, you know, certain times in our history, things happen and it cultivates a movement, a change.
Right.
And I'm not saying that, you know, what I did was anything other than me just wanting to do fun and exciting food. It wasn't meant to change the world. It wasn't meant to do anything except to just take our local ingredients, work with people who were just trying to sell their product. You know, like we had farmers, we had shrimpers, we had fishermen, we had people who were growing stuff in their backyards because we had, you know, we still, you know, our economy was still kind of at a lull and we were still trying to get our pieces back together. I mean, luckily it was, you know, thanks to the Saints winning the Super Bowl, it really kind of defibrillated the heartbeat of the city and it really kind of pushed us more into we want change. We have to have change just for our survival, for our future. And so it was that moment in time when I was like, I need to open up a restaurant. And that was the cultivation of Root. And you know, it blossomed into something great. You know, we were able to do some great things and really inspire and teach and do a lot of stuff and create relationships with a lot of people around the city and farmers and cultivate, you know, economic flow. And I think that's the most important thing, you know, in my eyes for the city.
Right.
It was a beautiful thing, Philip. It really was.
Isaac, let me, and I enjoyed that spot, really. Yeah. Isaac, let me ask you this question. Some of the things that these guys are talking about here, how did this affect your approach then? You sort of were, you know, you got both the best of the both worlds with the Cajun upbringing and background and approach to the culinary traditions there. But how did this affect you with these changes and what opened your doors to different things?
It definitely opened a lot of people's eyes. I noticed a change in the way customers were approaching food and approaching dining. There was definitely this lull in customers. I mean, people were straight up scared to come back to New Orleans, and a lot of people never did come back. But what I saw was this shift in dynamic of the way people dined. I noticed a lot of restaurants started just dropping off because people were tired of the crap. There were, you know, restaurants just putting out boring, bland stuff, and I think the customers, when they came back and finally started to come back, got tired of that. So we were able to break off, and Phil was able to open up the restaurants like that, and I was able to open up the meatery, where it's very Cajun and guttural focused, and people were accepting that. They want the new. They want the different, and we still can keep that vibe and still be Cajun and Creole and still keep it Southern. So that's what I saw. I really just saw that, you know, I'm careful when I say this because I don't think anything good came out of Katrina, but at the same time, what happened afterward did shine kind of a positive light on the culinary scene.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I agree with that, and I totally feel that sentiment too, Isaac. The way I put it is, as bad and as horrible an experience as Katrina was, I'm really glad I went through it.
Yeah.
Because I'm a better man for it.
Okay.
And then what it changed is our perspective. When everything's taken away from you, you really appreciate things like a bowl of gumbo and what that means. Mm-hmm. And I think restaurants were in a very fortuitous position to carry forward our culture and our heritage in that way, and I never felt luckier to do my job as then. It's funny how we started and or always come back to Katrina, but it's such a life-changing event that defines us. And 18 years, is that how many it is now?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
18 years later, I drove through Lakeview yesterday on the way to Station 6 for dinner, and we were going down Canal Boulevard, and you know, that whole area was totally devastated, and it was, I can still see it from 18 years ago. But the homes were so beautiful, and the neighborhoods were so beautiful, and so much vitality in life and belief that this is the right place to be.
Right. Great thought, great point, Frank. Let's do this, you guys. Can we take a little break here?
Sure.
And we'll come back. We're chatting with Chefs Frank Brightson, Philip Lopez, and Isaac Toops here at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. We're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show. Come on, Matt.
Brian Diaz here with the NOLA Drink Show. Hey, the second annual South African Wine Week returns to New Orleans from November 7th through the 13th. Explore this fascinating wine region, one of my favorites, that produces truly excellent wines all at a great value. Some of your favorite bars, restaurants, and bottle shops around the metro area will host dinners, happy hours, special tastings, and more. Join the conversation online using the hashtag SAWineWeek. To get more information and see event listings, visit SAWineWeekNOLA.com. Cheers, y'all.
The 12th annual Oak Street Po' Boy Fest is serving up a heaping portion of delicious food and music for one day only on Sunday, November 11th. The Po' Boy Festival features 60 variations of the unique New Orleans sandwich from 30 local food vendors, plus performances from the George Porter Trio, New Orleans Suspects with Jennifer Hartswick, the Iceman Special, and much more. General admission is free, and for more information, visit po'boyfest.com.
Goodbye, Joe. I got all right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Thanks for listening in this week. As always, here on the NOLA Drink Show, we are chatting with Chefs Isaac Toops, Philip Lopez, and Frank Brightson. Thanks for being here, you guys. And we were kind of breaking down some stuff for you, a little bit of an overview to a degree of Southern Louisiana cooking. But what about today, Isaac? You touched on this a little bit, but what you got two spots. You got Toops Meadery and Toops South, which is the newer one of the two.
Correct.
What's kind of the difference between the Meadery and Toops South?
The Meadery is my original guttural approach to exactly what I wanted to do. You get your restaurant and goes like, I don't have to answer to anyone now. Now I can do whatever I want. Oh, my God, what is that? So I was like, yeah, you can do it, but you don't know what that is. And I definitely knew I wanted to do Cajun food. At the same time, I didn't want to be a gumbo and po' boy shop. There was plenty of those around, and I didn't want the competition. And I just, like, only started cooking the things that I like to eat. And I like all of the animals. So I was like, you know what, I'm going to put a lamb neck on the menu. And you know what? I'm also going to do a bone marrow, but I want the humongous amount of bone marrow, like half a femur bone. And I want a place where you can get foie gras on your flip-flops. I'm going to make shirts with that on it because I think that's a cool tagline.
I
always wanted a super casual place that put just a lot of detail work into food and at the same time, not a whole lot of work on the plate-ups. You know, I don't do fancy plate-ups. And, you know, you can come to my restaurants in shorts. I don't care. The dress code at both my restaurants is wallet. And so that was my gut. It's my id. It's my very guttural approach. You're going to leave with a full belly. It's very rich. It's very fattening. It's very protein-based. The proteinery didn't sound as good. That's why we went with the Meadery.
I like Meadery.
But we also have a lot of seafood there, but it's understandable why people assume we don't. And South is, you know, kind of the guy I am now. I'm a little wiser, a little more educated, and it's, if I dare say, it's a little lighter and a little more coastal. So a little more on the seafood side, a little more on the fine dining side, I'll say, just kind of Toops refined, if you will.
Okay, got it. But wallet is still the dress code.
Wallet is still the dress code. Okay. You can still get boudin cracklings at both my restaurants. I didn't skew away from Cajun that far.
Dude, those are good, man, by the way.
The cracklings put my kids through school. People laugh at that. I'm like, no. They seriously put my children through school.
And it makes sense because I've tried them, and I mean, it made me want to go back to school.
Yeah, right.
Well, Philip, what about you? Because you've had an interesting journey, too. You're talking about Root, and then you had Square Root. Oh. And now you're in a place that might be called, I mean, very, very classic New Orleans Galatoire's.
Yes. You know, I'm the corporate executive chef for Galatoire's and the steakhouse, and you know, it's a crazy thing because people are always like, really, Philip Lopez at Galatoire's? How does that happen? And I was like, you know, Philip, you know, I always do what people least expect me to do. But you can't be a student of modern technique and modern cuisine without being somewhat of a master of the classics. And, you know, I've dedicated my whole life to cooking. I started when I was 13 years old in the kitchen, and I've just been head down like an ostrich, just grinding away and how to better my technique and how to better, you know, the people around me as well. And, you know, the opportunity came up and I was approached by it, and you know, it kind of caught me off guard a little bit. But then at the end of the day, I was like, it makes sense. It makes sense because this is one of the grand dames of New Orleans. It's a it's a beautiful restaurant with a beautiful history, and there's nothing like a Friday lunch at Galatoire's.
Absolutely, when, yeah.
And, you know, I always said, you know, even when I had talks with the CEO and the president of Galatoire's, Melvin, you know, he goes, what do you think Galatoire's is? And I said, well, to be honest with you, there are four things that are just synonymous to me about New Orleans. One is the smell of jasmine and magnolia, right? Two is the sound of the streetcar rolling down St. Charles Avenue. Three is the noise that you hear at the carriages in the French Quarter, the carriage rides. And lastly is all these beautiful people dressed up on a Friday morning, standing in line in their Sunday best. And, you know, growing up, I literally always thought that, you know, when my parents would get ready, they were going to church. And my mother would have a bag, you know, her purse full of cash. And I'm thinking that they're literally going to church. And lo and behold, they were going to lunch at Galatoire's. And, you know, people, my family is very old school, right? So they would hide money in, like, different places of the house, you know, just rainy day occasions. But my mother always had a drawer that she called the Galatoire's drawer. And it was like, you know, that's where you keep the money for Galatoire's. And I was never allowed anywhere near that. But, you know, so to be able to grow up underneath that idea and then to come back and lead that kitchen and lead those people is actually a really big honor for me. And you know what? There's a lot of room for creativity. There's a lot of room for enhancement. There's a lot of room for great things for that place. And, you know, to be able to carry on that tradition and help refine and help you know, lead the next generation of chefs is a big testament.
Philip, you actually anticipated the question I was going to have. So I think a lot of people think when somebody takes a job there in the kitchen, you know, you're being handed, you know, the dusting off the cookbook and saying, you will cook this.
No.
And that is not the case.
No, that is not the case. And we do have literally a century worth of recipes, don't get me wrong, but they're not set in stone. They're able to be refined and enhanced and to be better. So, you know, Galatoire's, yes, the menu at Galatoire's, you know, has been kind of sedimentary, but for me, it's always about how do we make those things better? How do we make the techniques of the cooks in the kitchen that have been kind of like uninspired and really kind of, you know, been doing the same routine over and over again. How do I make them better at their jobs? How do I teach them how to do it a different way? How to do it in a more modern sense, mm-hmm. behind the walls. And then in the dining room, how do we make that experience even more better? Like, you know, it's hard to say because, you know, my first Friday lunch at Galatoire's, there was a table of 14 people celebrating three divorce parties at that table. and there was like at least five bottles of champagne. And I kid you not, like I was having a conversation with my back turned to the table and all I felt is, you know, hands all over me. And I turned around and I said, ladies.
Ladies, please, two at a time.
Yeah. And you know, the lady was holding the sign and it said, shut up and move out. Right. And then you turn it around and it said, open your mouth, move in. And I said, only at Galatoire's on the lunch could this ever exist. But it is that feeling of nostalgia, as well as that feeling of being able to just be yourself. And that is what Galatoire's is. And, you know, it's just, I'm still in shock and awe at the amount of tenure that some of these people have had in that restaurant, not only in the front of the house, in the back of the house. So to be able to help them and teach them not only how to be better servers, better cooks, better chefs, it's a huge undertaking, and it's a very humbling experience.
That's great, man. Yeah. That's awesome. Frank, now in your case, so you mentioned this at the beginning that you had worked with Chef Paul Prudhomme, and then you opened your spot in the mid-80s, correct, Brightson's? Is that about
yes,
right?
Yes, that's right. 1986. We've been there 32 years now. And thanks to Chef Paul and his late wife, Kay. Paul gave me a chance when I was a young man. I met him when he was the chef at Commander's Palace, and I applied for a job. And after three long conversations, he said, Frank, we're going to give you a chance. He said, but you have a choice. We'll hire you as a broiler cook, and we'll put you on the front line and pay you a good wage, and we'll expect a lot out of you. Or you can start as an apprentice in the pantry, making very little money, but you can expect a lot out of me. And that's what I chose.
Wow.
So that was my culinary school, my 6 months at Commander's Palace. And then he took me to Kay Paul's, which I'd never heard of, and then we opened for dinner there. And so after 7 years with Paul and Kay, they called me out, sat me down. They said, Frank, we think you're ready to go out on your own. He remembered that I had mentioned that one day I'd like to have my own little place. And so they made Brightson's happen. They lent me the money and the staff and the support to get open. And I'm eternally grateful for that. And so now, 32 years later, my mission in life is to do the same for others.
That's great, Frank.
Yeah, that's awesome. Both in my kitchen and in the classrooms where I teach, I'm there to give people a chance. I've been teaching classes for the last 15 years for the public, but most recently it's in the classroom at John Foss Culinary Institute at Nicholls State and Thibodaux, which is university level, and then also for the last 9 years in the culinary arts program at NOCA, New Orleans Center for the Creative Arts, in a $2.5 million kitchen that was gifted to NOCA by the Emeril Lagasse Foundation.
Yeah. That's a great segue. So let's do this, you guys. Let's take a little break here, and then we're going to come back and talk about an event that matters to the three of you a whole lot coming up here shortly, November 9th, Boudin Bourbon and Beer. It's a 3 B's, and I think I got them in the right order. And we're going to talk about that great event put on by the Emeril Lagasse Foundation. Friends, we're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show. Come on back.
We could use a little something to eat, so we went to a house on Rampart Street. Well, my bucket's got a hole in it. My bucket's got a hole in it. My bucket's got a hole in it. I can't buy no beer. Well, I'm standing on a corner with the bucket in my hand. I'm just looking for a woman that ain't got no man. My bucket's got a hole in it. Yeah, my bucket's got a hole in it. My bucket's got a hole in it. I can't buy no beer. Yes, I went up on a mountain. I looked down on the sea. I seen the crabs and the fish, yeah, doing the beep by beep. Cause my bucket's got a hole in it.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land wherever you may be. Thanks for listening in this week. We are here at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, as we often are taping the show, and I'm very pleased and honored to be joined by three fantastic, talented chefs, Isaac Toops, Philip Lopez, and Frank Brightson. And you guys, we were kind of all gathered here today. We talked about some other stuff, but great event coming up put on by the Emeril Lagasse Foundation, Boudin Bourbon and Beer, on November 9th at Champion Square. And Frank, we'll kick it to you first. What does it mean to be involved with that great event that raises a lot of fantastic money for children's charities?
Well, let me tell you something. The Bourbon, Boudin and Beer event, number one, is the best food event of the year. It's the most fun. I would never miss it.
In this town, so that's saying a lot.
Yeah, and there's a lot of fundraisers, believe me, but there's nothing like this one. And this started 8 or 9 years ago. Chef Emeril's main fundraiser for the foundation is Carnaval du Vin, which is a high-ticket sit-down dinner on Saturday night in November. And he always had a reception on the Friday before for his guests from out of town, the winemakers and visiting friends. And it was a private reception. And that was great, but they wanted to open it up to the public and make something more accessible. And so this party started, and it grew and grew and grew. And so now we're at Champion Square, and it's 5,000 people hanging out. There's 60 to 70 chefs serving some riff on Boudin or sausage, live music, usually a visit by the 610 Stompers, which is always the highlight for me. But there's two things I really love about the event. Number one is the camaraderie of hanging out with my buddies, men and women that run the restaurants of this area and visiting chefs from around the country. This is our chance to be with one another. But number two is Emeril does such wonderful things with the monies raised by this event. You know, he raises, I guess, a couple, $3 million a year. Mm-hmm. And almost all of it goes to be an investment in the future. It goes to culinary education. It goes to high school programs. It goes to youth development programs like Cafe Reconcile. So this is his way of giving back and his way of giving others an opportunity to grow and become themselves. And that is the lesson from this event, is everyone deserves a chance. Everyone deserves a hand up, and that's what this event does.
Mm-hmm. Great, Frank. Philip, what does it mean for you to participate in this event?
Well, it's always like what Frank said. It's the biggest chef party in New Orleans, and it happens every year. It happens at usually the first Friday of November. So it's like my calendar is always blacked out for that. Like I've dedicated myself to Boudin Bourbon and Beer since the moment I met Emerald. He came to my restaurant when we first opened up, and I met Emerald and Chris Wilson, who's his corporate executive chef. And they're both great people, and you know, he kind of looked at me. He goes, bruh, everything was amazing. And he goes, I got this event I'm doing here in the city I want you to be a part of. And I said, hell yeah. and so the first time I did it, you know, and it's grown exponentially since then. It's probably been about 8 years since I started doing it. And, you know, I was kind of like a little almost depressed, because when I became the chef of Galatoire's, it was like, it was already kind of almost too late to sign up for it. And then I got a call from Molly, who's in charge of leading the event. She goes, this event wouldn't be it is without you. So, you know, can you do it? And I was like, hell yeah. The same response I said the first time. So I'm excited to be back and part of it. And it's going to be fun. Like, you know, and not only that, but it, like Frank said, it goes to a great cause. It's a lot of work. It's like 5,000 people. It's like turn and burn it. The last, you know, it's a lot of work. But one thing Emerald and Donald know how to do is throw a good after party.
Yeah, there you go. Well, what about you, Isaac? How many times have you participated, and what does it mean for you to participate in this?
I participate in every single one.
Oh, okay.
It's a no-brainer for me. Mm-hmm. I worked for Chef Emerald for 10 years, mm-hmm. a decade of my life, from 2000 to 2010. And, you know, first I was the fry cook, and he don't know my name. And by the end of it, I'm going over to his house and help out with stuff. So my love for Chef Emerald just is super deep. He wrote the foreword to my book, Chasing the Gator, Selfless Promotion.
Is that the new book coming out, right? We're going to work that in.
But,
and you did already.
But,
well done.
But Boudin Bourbon and Beer, it is the best event. And what I like it about it, Boudin Bourbon and Beer, is that all the chefs actually show up themselves. It's the one event you can guarantee that Donald Link's going to be there, and Frank's going to be there, and I'm going to be there, and Philip's going to be there. We're all there because we know everybody else is going to be there. Mm-hmm. And we put a whole lot of effort into it. And it's just, I mean, not only is it fun, it's fun with a cause. We're doing just a wonderful job for the foundation and for the money he raised. And as far as, you know, family ties to it, I've been knowing Chef Ramon now 18 years. Molly Loubier, I've known since she was a child, a family friend. So I know all those people from way back when. So I go to Boudin Bourbon and Beer and know everybody.
Right.
So it's a no-brainer for me.
Well, and thanks for saying that too, because you anticipated something I wanted to bring up. You said this. It's not, you're not sending staff. And this is no disrespect for anybody that works for anybody, but it's the chefs themselves. It's you guys that are actually there. That's part of this.
Absolutely. Well, I have a waiting list of volunteers that want to be with me.
Yeah, as chefs in the city, we get inundated every year, like multiple thousands of times sometimes, with just, you know, foundations and party requests and things like that. And, you know, we do have to be able to prioritize, you know, what is important for us and our causes and what we want to associate with. And by far, you know, Emeril Lagasse has set himself as one of those people who have led the way in taking care of not only the future of chefs, but also, you know, children and just spending that money in the right way.
Yeah.
And so it's important for us to be able to work hard for that.
It's a great event, you guys. And so we ran this down at the top of the show. Be sure to go check out the website. You can buy tickets. It's absolutely worth going to. Don't miss it. Well, do me a favor, you guys. We've got about 2 minutes left before we got to close out the radio portion. You guys are going to stick around for another shot with NOLA Drinks, where we're going to talk a little bit more about the culinary tradition here in the region. But, Frank, can you tell people where they can find you at Brightson's, both where the restaurant itself is and how to connect with you there online?
Right. Brightson's restaurant is at 723 Dante Street. We're in the River Bend of New Orleans. That's off Carrollton and St. Charles by the river. We're in an old house. We have a website, brightsens.com, B-R-I-G-T-S-E-N-S. And if you're really bored, you can follow me on Instagram or Facebook, Frank Brightson.
Yeah, and we'll be tagging you in the post so you can easily find Frank that way. And you guys do dinner Tuesday through
Saturday? We do dinner only Tuesday through Saturday nights, closed Sundays and Mondays, and all major holidays.
Gotcha. Great. Philip, where can we find you there at the famous Grand Dame that is Galatoire's?
Galatoire's is located on the 200 block, 209 of Bourbon Street. So as soon as you walk in, you'll see us right on the left-hand side off of Canal. It is by far a staple. It is the Grand Dame of New Orleans. So if you get a chance, come check us out. You'll find me there every single day.
Every single day. Friday lunch included.
Especially Friday lunch.
Yeah, right on. And Isaac, what about you? Where do we find Tube South and Tube's Meadery, man?
We have Tube's Meadery on 845 North Carrollton in Mid-City. And Tube South is 1504 Aretha Castle Haley inside the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Yep. You can find me on the Instagram at Tube's Meadery and Tube South if you want to be entertained.
Oh, very good, very good. And a real quick, title of the new cookbook?
Chasing the Gator.
And you can get that here at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum.
You can get it here
at the
Southern Food and Beverage Museum coming out October 23rd or pre-order at Amazon.com. Forward written by Emeril Lagasse.
Hey, very good. Nice. Hell nice work. Yeah. You guys, thanks very much for being here. You guys are going to stick around for the podcast, the only thing. But if you're listening on the radio, we're going to sign this off right now. So friends, remember, be kind to one another. Use your turn signal. And until then, cheers, y'all. Thanks for sticking around for another shot with Nola Drinks. Brian Diaz here with you. Hope you are enjoying our conversation with chefs Frank Brightson, Isaac Toops, and Philip Lopez. Really a lot of fun chatting with these guys, and we're going to get right back over to the Southern Food and Beverage Museum and continue our conversation with them, and hopefully we'll see y'all out there at Boudin Bourbon and Beer on Friday, November 9th, a great event. We'll be out there. Really looking forward to it. And then I'll be back with my parting shot. Here we go. All right, everybody. Yeah, we're here with another shot with Nola Drinks. Thanks for sticking around. Brian Diaz here with you. And yeah, we're here at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. One place that you can actually get this show, if you wanna, is on the Southern Food and Beverage Museum's podcast network called Nitty Grits Media. Yeah, that's where we have the show. And we're sitting here in the museum chatting with chefs Isaac Toops, Philip Lopez, and Frank Brightson. Thanks, guys, for being here and taking some time. It's been a pleasure to chat with you, get you all in one space. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I tell you what, we don't get to sit down at a table very often, so... This is actually a treat.
That's cool.
And we got not together.
Yeah, right.
If I want to see these guys, they got to come to one of my restaurants. I got to go to one of theirs.
Yeah, and then they're working, right?
So right. So one of us is always working.
Mm-hmm. Or we go to Boudin Bourbon and Beer.
Or we go to Boudin Bourbon
or Restaurant Depot.
Or Restaurant. Yeah, I was going to say you guys run into each other at Restaurant Depot.
Right.
Well, and we are sipping on a little bourbon here, which seems appropriate for that event coming up. And we were talking about Boudin Bourbon and Beer on November 9th and the Lagasse Foundation and how, Frank, you said this, how it creates an opportunity to give everybody a chance and for kids to develop a future. And in many cases, the emphasis on the culinary arts. In this part of the world, and I think people from outside maybe don't understand this, when somebody opens up a restaurant here, it's kind of like increasing the size of the family, right? And in a lot of instances, all of you had the opportunity to benefit from someone's guidance and support and these things. And that's an important part of the culinary tradition here in New Orleans and really in Southeast Louisiana in general, isn't it, Frank?
Oh, I think so. I think, you know, I kind of amusingly say, but I mean it, the best chefs or the best cooks in Louisiana are not in the restaurant kitchens. They're in the homes. And so we naturally grow up with this incredible food heritage in our mom's kitchen. And whether it's mom, dad, Uncle Joe, or whoever it might be, we eat well. And so we have a palate that's kind of accustomed to very satisfying flavors, deep flavors. And so when we go into our restaurants, we carry that with us. You know, I grew up at Commander's Palace with some of the greatest Creole chefs you've never heard of. We didn't have recipes back then at all, none that I remember. You were taught dish by dish by someone that worked in the kitchen. And I think Creole cuisine was carried from generation to generation just like that for hundreds of years at Galatoire's, yes, and Antoine's, at Commander's. And I feel very fortunate to have had that. You know, I'm very thankful for those cooks that took the time to take a young man under their wing and show him how to fry a fish or how to make remoulade or whatever it might be. And when I opened my restaurant, I had no recipes either, and I really hated writing them. You know, you go do a TV show and, oh yeah, bring your recipe. Oh no, really? But now I have recipes for everything that I do, and every cook in my kitchen has their own binder of recipes. And that's the way we achieve consistency. It's the way I want it. It's the best I can make that dish, follow the recipe. And so this is my way of fostering a continuation of this cuisine, my cuisine anyway. And those are the recipes I teach in schools as well. And I feel very lucky to have that opportunity to share in that way. And that's why I started teaching at Nicholls State. You know, I called them up, and this was after Katrina. I felt it was very important for me to do what I could to protect and preserve Creole culinary traditions. And I wanted the next generation to have that. And so that's why I started teaching. Not for a job, but to keep this going. We're all part of a continuum here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
that's a unique thing in America. And to carry that forward. And every day that I put on that white chef's jacket, I'm putting on 300 years of culinary tradition.
Mm-hmm. Well said, Frank. Let me flip the order here, because I want to ask you this question, Isaac. When you, in your two spots, when you look to hire somebody and you bring somebody aboard, what are you looking for, man? How do you go about that?
You know, culinary experience means less to me than attitude and ethic. I say it all the time. The best cooks are the ones you grow yourselves. Perfect example, the chef de cuisine right now at Meadery is a wonderful young lady named Courtney Hellenschmidt. She walked into the Meadery 7 years ago in short shorts, applying for the dishwasher position. Well, I'm an equal opportunity abuser, so I'll hire anybody. And sure enough, she turned out to be a great dishwasher, great prep cook, great line cook, and now she heads my flagship restaurant.
And she came all the way up.
All the way from the top. Never had stepped foot into a restaurant. And that just goes to say, for especially the millennials, it's always going to be the individuals that pop out. Some of the best cooks I know didn't go to culinary school. I didn't go to culinary school. I didn't even start cooking until I was 21. But my mother and father and grandparents all taught me their recipes and their ways. So I could walk into a restaurant at 21 and still shuck an oyster better than half the crew. So it's all, I look for attitude. I look for ethic. I look for people who are hungry and want to learn. You got a chip on your shoulder and you turn your nose up at stuff, get out of here. Mm-hmm. I don't want you. Mm-hmm. You know, culinary school is nice, but I know a bunch of cooks who have been to culinary school and a bunch of have not, and I see about the same amount get successful. It's all about individualism. It's all about people putting forth ethic and wanting to put in the time to do something right.
Got it. Good one. Philip, with you guys now, I mean, and there's probably been a little bit of a shift here. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but between Galatoire's and say what you were doing at Root and Square Root and such, At what point, when you have somebody come in, at what point do you start to give them some latitude, right? I mean, I think it's always a learning process, both sort of downhill and uphill, right? People bring things to the table. And at what point do you sort of look to say, hey, man, why don't you take your shot at this, or what's your take on this?
Well, you know, I always tell people when I sit down and hire them, I was like, you know, everyone in this world has the capabilities of being great.
I mean, they do. You know, my mother always told me when I was growing up, she goes, and she, you know, I always say this because she speaks with a strong Spanish accent. She goes, mijo, she goes, if you always aim for the moon, one day you'll hit a star, you know? And she goes, you know, you can go to school, you can go to college, you can go to work. Each path leads in the same direction. It's just one will be a lot more difficult to travel, mm-hmm. and the other one may be a little bit more easier. She goes, I can't tell you which one that will be, but you have to make the choices on which path you want to take. And, you know, it's funny that I just found out that all three of us at this table never went to culinary school, right? but, you know, we've all grew up in the business. We've all worked our butts off and our asses off, and we've got to where we are. And it's a testament to the passion, you know? And I, you know, Isaac talks about ethic and just the ability to accomplish, right? And to me, a lot of it has to be about passion. I grew up in a very passionate household, right? We always, dinner and food was always a big thing in our family. You know, my father was adamant that you turn the TV off, you set the table, right? If the phone rang, he'd freak out. He's like, it's 7 o'clock, it's supper. I'm like, Dad, no one knows, you know, like no one knows that we're having dinner right now. But it was a thing. Like, it was a time where you came together as a family at the table. You talked about your problems, you talked about your future, all these things. And everything about that involved food. You know, we eat to celebrate, we eat to mourn, you know, we eat to survive sometimes. But here in New Orleans, you know, we live to eat. We don't eat to live. And
right.
That's a big
right.
difference.
Yep.
And so that, for me, it's always about the person that walks in that door. If they're passionate and they're willing to not necessarily sacrifice, but dedicate themselves to their craft, I'm willing to dedicate myself to them.
Right.
And that's an important thing because, you know, I always tell them, I was like, I can give you all these tools. I can give you all this information. I can give you all these recipes. I can show you techniques. I can show you all this shit, right? And you'll learn it. The one thing you have to understand is I can never take that back. And so what you do with it, that's up to you.
Right.
That is up to you. And that's a very powerful, powerful thing.
Right.
And so, you know, growing up in the business, and I realized that at a very young age that this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. And I didn't look back. And I grabbed every single ounce of technique and information and just education that I could possibly find, because I made that decision to continue on in cooking and not go to culinary school because I already had the foundation already set aside. You know, the culinary school teaches you that foundation. They teach you the book smarts of it, but mm-hmm. they don't teach you the nitty gritty of what you have to do to survive.
How a kitchen really works and survive.
It's a tough business. Mm-hmm. And you know, you work the hours of a doctor, but you make the salary of a shoemaker for years and years. Right. And you know, like this whole rise of the rock star culinary, you know, chef world, that's only the 1% of the 1%. You know, that is like the billionaires, that is like the Bill Gates and the Warren Buffetts, right? Mm-hmm. But the rest of the world has to fight and strive to be successful, yeah. just to stay alive, just to be able to turn that stove on the next
day. Just to stay in business. And people, we've, and that's something, Philip, we've actually talked a lot on this show about the restaurant industry, both here and abroad. And, you know, and we don't have to go down that road today because we've worn that road out in the past few months. But it's, as you said, it's a tough business, man.
It's
not for the faint of heart. And we see so many places. We were just kind of walking by a place, my wife and I, the other day in the CBD that I won't name, that was probably in business, I mean, I think like 4 or 5, 6 months. You know, people aren't coming in capitalized properly. People aren't making smart decisions. You know, it's that sort of if you build it, they will come thing, and it doesn't work. You got to be prepared to gut it out for a couple of years at least, right? And
I mean, that's why it's so important for chefs like us to carry on that tradition
exactly,
of teaching
exactly.
the next generation. Because if not, I mean, you can open up a business and close it the next day, and all everything that you have personally will die within that moment.
With that moment, you're absolutely right, Philip. Frank, let me ask you this, because, you know, in the 30-some odd years that you've had Brightsons, you've seen, I'm sure, then sort of more than one wave of people come under your tutelage or under your guidance and work for you and then move on to do something for themselves. How rewarding is that? Because you've said it very clearly, you support that. It's got to be great to see people move on and succeed.
It is. It's a beautiful thing. And I think we all owe that attitude to Miss Ella Brennan. Ella Breton, who was a matriarch of the commander's family for so many years, passed away last year, and there was a documentary made about her. And when I saw it, there was some footage and the story of her early years when she was a young lady working at her family restaurant on Bourbon Street, their first restaurant. And one thing that she did, this is what struck me about the movie. She had to promote the restaurant. In order to do that, she went up and down Bourbon Street, knocking on every door, every restaurant, every bar, every strip joint, knocking on the door, introducing herself, and saying, we need to promote ourselves together. And I think that was the basis for the sense of community that we feel in the New Orleans restaurant world today. She has always made us feel that way. When Chef Paul left to open Cape Paul's, he left with her blessing. When Emerald left to open Emerald's, he left with her blessing. It's a community. It's not a competition. And that's why I love being a New Orleans chef. And so when my former employees go out and follow their dreams, Greg Sonier, Gabrielle, there's quite a few. Andy Blanton has his own restaurant in Whitefish, Montana, and he's a brilliant young chef. It's just, you know, again, part of this continuum. And you have to understand that. Nothing is static. Nothing is forever. It's a process. And giving, I mean, today in my kitchen, I'm not on a station, but I'm there every night that I can be, and I love it. And I'm what you call a floater. And what I'm floating on is a cloud because I'm watching my young chefs grow and become who they really want to be. Most of my chefs were students of mine also, which is fortuitous. But they're doing what I used to do when I worked the line. They're doing the things that I did for 20-something years. And to watch them perform this orchestrated dance that is service in a restaurant kitchen, it's the most gratifying thing in the world.
Great. Let me ask you guys this question real quick. I'm going to ask you two more questions each, but you kind of led up to this, Frank, here a little bit. One of the things that we know, and I think that we see here in New Orleans where it's put on a pedestal and rightfully should be, and really makes a difference here, it really is part of the fabric of all of this, hospitality. And the sense of hospitality in a restaurant, I think in certain parts of the country, certain parts of the world, there's that too cool for school thing. I hate to kind of phrase it that way, but there's a lot of that where, hey, you know, I got this award, I got this accolade, I'm the coolest chef on the block, so you're going to come to my place and damn it, you're going to like my food and I'm just going to, you know, I can just be an asshole. Here that doesn't fly, right, Isaac, in New Orleans, I don't think particularly well. I've seen a few people come and go in the past handful of years in this town who have had that attitude. It just doesn't cut it.
Yeah, we really don't care about all your accolades. I mean, no one cares about your accolades. My mom cares about my accolades, but I don't think you know, oh, you made the paper. Yeah, that's nice, but that doesn't make customers happy. Yeah. Consistent food and consistent service make people happy, and that's what New Orleans, especially New Orleans, just demands. And speaking on what Frank said about the community, I'm not going to name cities, but New Orleans is one of the few places where, like, Frank's my friend and Phillip's my friend, where in other big cities, we'd be cutthroat talking smack about other people, throwing people under the bus, saying, oh, no, those cooks over there, they're not worth anything. And you almost never hear that type of talk in New Orleans. It really is a community.
Yep.
Right. We really can get together and, you know, I say put feelings aside. We didn't have feelings in the first place.
Yeah.
Not unless we have like some sort of severe personal problem. And even that, for Boudin, bourbon, and beer, things like that, we just put that aside. So this is this sense, you know, I was born and raised into it. In New Orleans food scene, I thought everybody else did this, when in fact that's not very true at all.
It's something
very unique to New Orleans, and you know, you go to try to cook other places, you realize like, no, I'd rather just stay in New Orleans.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Yeah, absolutely. Well, Phil, what does hospitality mean to you, man? Especially given where you've worked, and then now where you're at Galatoire's, because that place is built on that in a big way.
My whole philosophy has never changed from the time I started in the business to even today. But we're in the South, and you know, we kind of do things differently down here in more ways than one, politics and all that shit. But our most important thing is we don't say no. You know what I mean? Like, it's a business first and foremost, but it is a extension of our home. And, you know, we have to be able to, when people come in the door and You know, granted, you know, we may have some things on the menu that they don't perceive very well. We don't say no. They want a T-bone steak from across the street. Okay, absolutely. you know, it has always been my job to go far beyond what I need to do to make somebody happy. First and foremost, because they keep the lights on. But secondly, it is the hospitality industry. I mean, you look at the definition of what that is, mm-hmm. and it's we're here to cater to your needs. Mm-hmm. I grew up in a very family oriented environment to where everything was always about, you know, what can I do for you? How can I help you? You know, the funny story is that, you know, growing up, I was always trained. I was always told that, you know, elderly person, you help them across the street. My parents live in San Antonio, Texas. And I went back there a few months ago to go visit them. And I was in downtown San Antonio. And there was an old man, literally an old man, in his mid-80s, cowboy hat, cowboy boots, two fucking six-shooters strapped to his sides. And I was like, good God. And I was like, this man, he can't even cross the street. So I went up to him and I was like, sir, I was like, can I help you cross the street? And he kind of just tilted his hat up and looked at me and goes, son, the day I can't load bullets into my gun is the day I ain't going to need help crossing the street. And I was like, you're absolutely right. I apologize. But it is that mentality is that, you know, we go far beyond our need to make sure that, you know, our guests are happy. And because they're an extension of our home. And mm-hmm. the restaurant is an extension of our home. I mean, we spend more time in the restaurants than we actually do in our own home. So, literally... It's a family that coincides on both ends, and so it's important for us to be able to treat every person that walks in that door with the utmost respect.
Yeah, great. Yeah. And Frank, and to you then on that front, I know one of the things that you guys got a Beard Award not too long ago, right, for hospitality, if I remember correctly. Is that right?
Well,
or nominated at least, right?
Yeah, we've been nominated as semifinalists for our service for a few years,
yep.
and that's a real testament to the service staff up front. And that's the way Bryson's has always been. We want to be professional but friendly, not pretentious. And we hear the same comment quite a bit is it's like coming to someone's home, and that's exactly what we want to hear. We're a family-run operation. You know, my wife and I are the owners and operators. Her two sisters who worked with me at K. Paul's are also working there. Chef Larry's been there 20-some-odd years. We lost count. I have a dishwasher that's been there 25 plus years. So we are family, and that is something that we never consciously had to nurture. It's just been that way, and that's a beautiful thing. You know, there's always a little bump in the road here and there, but we take care of each other. And when I leave the restaurant, if I have to go do an event or something or go teach, my departing words when I walk out the kitchen is, be careful, be nice to each other, and make them happy. Mm-hmm. And that's the way we do it.
That's great, Frank. Yeah, there you go. Well, last question, you guys. I'll throw it out to any of you if you care to divulge. Any plans for Boudin Bourbon and Beer menu-wise that you want to share with us, or is it a trade secret at this
I'm
point?
I'm going old school.
Are you going old school?
The first couple times I did it, I was like, do something eccentric. So I actually brought Shodan one time, which is stuffed pig stomach. And then like, okay, that was an epic go-down. Just an epic go-down. Like face down on a cutting board, slicing 2,000 portions of Shodan. Utter go-down. Then I used to bring... cracklins and chicken liver mousse. I actually brought chicken liver mousse in an industrial mayonnaise gun and would just point and click. It was super simple, but then Molly asked me to stop bringing fryers because of the cleanup. So you know, well, what am I going to do this year? I was racking my brain like, you know what? I'm going old school. I'm just bringing a link of boudin, white bread, and mustard.
Oh, yeah.
That's nice. That's it. That's the white bread is the napkin and the holder, the hot boudin.
Nice.
So I was like, you know what? Why am I overthinking this? Make some good boudin, load it up with chicken liver. I use chicken liver instead of pork liver.
Okay.
And beauty and simplicity. Walk around with your sandwich.
I dig it, man. Nice. I love mustard.
Isaac, you ever heard of a roux sandwich?
A what?
A roux sandwich.
A roux sandwich, no.
I had a buddy of mine from Iota.
Uh-huh.
And he was like, yeah, growing up, when my mom was making the roux, she just slapped a little bit on some white bread and handed it to me.
That actually sounds gross.
And I was just like, oh, you were tortured as a kid.
Yeah, I was just saying, was that a joke? Is that something, watch, I'm making me the roux sandwich.
That's kind of like a hush puppy, but like hush, son.
Yeah. Keep your mouth full.
Oh, yeah.
So what about you, Phil? You want to divulge, man, or you got a plan yet? And if you don't, it's cool. I just wondered.
You know, it's still kind of in the process, but, you know, I always tend to, overwork it in the front end to make it very easy on the back end. You know, to me, that's what modern cuisine is. It's really to utilize new techniques to make it the execution a lot more simpler. In the prep stages, it's a little bit more difficult and more technique driven. And so, you know, obviously, I want to do a play on an old Galatoire's riff, and it's going to go into a Boudin form. And you know, I try to make it as fun and exciting as possible in the execution stage, because I think, you know, when I always talk about food, I always talk about going back to your childhood when you're, as a little kid, maybe strapped in that high chair and you're at your mom's feet and you have SpaghettiOs or something like that, and you're kind of just smashing it with your hands and just putting it all over your face. You know, that moment in life, you tend to forget about or not worry about anything, right? The only thing that exists is being able to get this shit in your mouth. And, you know, people always ask me, this plate is so beautiful, how do I eat it? And I was like, you know, your first rule is to get the fork in from the plate to the mouth.
Aim it to your mouth.
Yeah, as efficient as possible. But so, you know, yeah, we're gonna do a play on an old Galatoire's classic recipe, but in a new modern sense, and in Boudin format. So,
sweet. Looking forward to it.
Me too.
Frank, what about you?
Well, some of the things I've done over the years include sweet potato Boudin. Boudin with candy sweet potatoes, delicious. Duck Boudin, egg rolls. Yes. Last couple of years, we've been doing actually a vegetarian take on Boudin, because there's a lot of meat there. And,
and there's really?
A lot of folks, you know, don't do meat. And so we provide something as an alternative. And Chef Emily Pfeiffer from Brightson's created this incredibly delicious smoked mushroom Boudin. And we've done that the past couple of years. Big hit. This year I'm going back to meat, and I'm going to touch on the Spanish and Latin heritage of Creole cuisine. We're going to do a Mexican chorizo sausage on a slice of roasted potato topped with mojo verde, which is a roasted pepper dipping sauce or condiment from the Canary Islands, a tribute to our precious Los Isleños heritage here in New Orleans.
That sounds awesome. That sounds pretty good.
That does sound good.
Yeah. Well, you guys, thanks very much. I really appreciate you taking some time out to be on the show, talk about Boudin bourbon and beer, share your thoughts on culinary tradition here and all that stuff. So I really appreciate it, guys. Pleasure to meet you all.
Thank you, Brian.
Yeah. Thanks for the drink. Yeah.
Hey, I'll bring bourbon to anything, man. Anytime. Friends, we're going to take a brief little musical interlude here, and I'll be back with my parting shot. Come on back. All right, everybody. Hey, thanks for listening into the NOLA Drink Show this week. As always, hope you enjoyed our conversation there at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Thanks to our friends there for hosting us with chefs Frank, Isaac, and Philip. I had a great time talking with those guys, sipping on a little Widow Jane bourbon, talking about Southern culinary traditions, and of course, the great event, Boudin Bourbon and Beer, coming up Friday, November 9th, Champion Square, right there at the Superdome in New Orleans. We'll be out there, so come say hi if you see us, and I hope you, if you are in the area, you're going to be in the area, go check out this great event. It's really a lot of fun. The money goes to a good cause, and it's actually like you get your money's worth when you're there in food and drink and entertainment. Believe me, it's really a great thing. Also want to say, if you're listening beforehand, happy Halloween. There you go. And also want to say, hey, if you're in this part of the world, happy end of hurricane season, which is right about now. Of course, we're still thinking about our friends, our neighbors there to the east in the Florida Panhandle, who took quite a beating as they continue to go through what is a long and slow trudge towards recovery. We know something about that here in New Orleans, don't we? So we'll be thinking about them if things come up in the particular industries that we talk about to benefit those in Florida. We will certainly let you know. Friends, this is our parting shot that we do, you know, every week here on the podcast on the NOLA Drink Show. One of the greatest rights and privileges that we have here in the U.S. is to vote. Look, I was very fortunate, and I had the opportunity to travel, to live, and to work in certain places where people often wait hours to vote. They do so oftentimes at risk of intimidation or even physical violence, sometimes resulting in death, just to do so. Here, it's our civic duty, and it honors those who came before us and those that paved our way to exercise that critical duty. These people did so in many ways, shapes, and forms, and they sometimes did so at great risk to themselves, simply so that we may have our voices heard. It's important to honor that legacy
and their sacrifices by speaking truth to power. And the best way that can begin is right at the ballot box. It's our chance to hold those in leadership accountable for their actions or their inactions. It's our opportunity to let those in power know they work for us. It is not the other way around. It's our referendum on their policies, on their priorities, and our acceptance or our disavowal of their rhetoric. It's our time to hold leaders accountable for misinformation, fanning hate and division, and using mistruths to motivate some while marginalizing others. It is also our time to hold those leaders that tacitly approve of this behavior by doing nothing, often motivated by stark self-interest. That is something that is supposed to be contradictory to holding public office. Regardless of the outcomes, friends, in the election next week, remember there are avenues for our voices to be heard. But again, the place to start is at the ballot box each and every time. I think most of us know that if the vast majority of us were to actually vote in each and every election, this country and really this world would be a very different place. So get out there and let's see what that world might start to look like beginning next week. Make your voices heard, friends. Get out and vote. Get out and vote. Get out and vote. That's our parting shot. Here's to you.
All these sciences, all these sinners will try.